You are listening to The Mombcast, the best weekly comic book podcast recorded in Southampton, England on Thursday nights.
Slightly poor taste.
I think we should just start. I think that's fine.
On that note, I think we should totally start.
Maybe we should just finish now. I don't know.
We've just recorded the last hour of us talking.
Yeah, I haven't. Thankfully, there's stuff in there I wouldn't want to share with people.
Good idea, I agree.
You're joining us for Mombcast, whichever number it is that it says at the top of the episode.
204, isn't it?
Probably 204, yeah.
Or 204.1, I don't know.
No, I think it's 204. This is me, Nick. Hello.
Hello.
And that's...
I'm John.
Say hello.
Hello.
Say hello, damn it.
Hello, damn it, I'm John.
Okay, good. We aren't starting the way we normally are, but I get the feeling if we don't start now, we never will. Literally, John and I have been sat here for an hour chatting already, so we'll try and keep this one short. There is no Jane... She is not here, sadly. But she's the only person who isn't here. I'm doing it, John. I'm rolling with what we talked about last week.
Yeah,
she's John. The only one who isn't here. There is no Jane, and usually it's just me and Jane, and sometimes John comes in. But there is no Jane this week. Jane is having a micro holiday in Spain, in Spain, somewhere. I don't know. So she's not here. John and I have been talking for a really long time, but I am still going to ask him what he's been up to this week, because I'm kind of interested, because that's the one thing we haven't talked about.
This week, I've not been doing a lot. I am currently unemployed, so I'm just wandering around doing stuff.
Man of leisure.
Yeah, well, I was going to say I've written a couple of blogs, sort of done a bit of job hunting, and... I've bought my comics.
Those are the blogs are on Mom Comics, aren't they?
Yeah, they're not on there yet. I will be publishing them over the next couple of days.
That's momcomics.com. You can go there to listen to any of the previous episodes of this and to read reviews and stuff like that. There are some. Hopefully, I mean, obviously it'd be good if John got a job sometime soon for him, but there might be quite a few reviews going up over the next few weeks. Because as he's not at work at the moment, it's either that or masturbating. Or, well, I mean, I don't know why you can't do both, to be fair.
Yeah, well, both create calluses.
Yes, yes. And I'm not sure that I, for one, can afford to become more callous. That's a terrible, terrible pun. I've basically been doing the same stuff that I've been doing for the last few weeks. John, that's what I've been doing. Lots of podcasting.
Yep.
A new episode of Unanswered went up this week. It's really good. I think it's really good. I get really confused because we record one the same day that the previous one goes up.
Okay.
And it's been a month and I don't know. I get very confused. I've had a bit of caffeine today, which is why I'm a bit all over the place. And there's a baby, but I've kind of got used to him. I mean, I love him. I'm glad he's there.
That's good.
But he's kind of just fit into my routine. Which is watch some TV with my wife and the baby's there, and then go online and play Avengers Alliance on Facebook for hours, even though it isn't really a game. The thing I've been trying to do this week is I've been trying to get to, you know, is it called the Humble Bundle?
There's
a
thing.
Indie Humble Bundle. Yeah, you can, well...
On Steam.
The one I bought was, it wasn't the indie one, it was, you pay something like £5 or £10 and you get a whole bunch of games, and so I got Battlefield and I got Mirror's Edge on the PC because I want to see what that's like on the PC. I didn't get on with it on the Xbox. And so there's a bunch of games, and I keep sitting down, and I've still got a Shogun Total War 2 game on the go, and I keep sitting down at my computer thinking, I could write, or I could play one of these games. The real plan is to open up some of these games and see if I enjoy them, and I end up opening up Facebook and
playing
Avengers Alliance instead, even though it isn't a real game, and it might be a bit misogynist.
Is it?
I think I told. Did I tell
you
that we
discussed this last week?
If you have more than three female characters on your team, you get loads of bonuses for like flirtatious and girls' night out. And another thing that happened this week is I accidentally heard Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines for the first time. That's a horrible little song.
Was this the thing he did with Miley Cyrus at the VMAs?
It might have been the thing he did with Miley. This is the video of it with Farrell. He's with Farrell, that guy Farrell.
Have you seen the photo of Robin Thicke that came out this week where he had his picture taken with a fan, and she posted it on her Instagram, and basically the picture was taken in front of a mirror, and you can actually see that he's got his hand on her butt.
That's so rude, but he's happily married.
Yeah.
On Wikipedia, I was reading about it because I became obsessed. It's a really catchy song, and it's the most hideous thing. Like, I have come to acknowledge happily and unironically that I like the song Call Me Maybe. I like it. It's catchy, but it's also quite sweet. There's nothing, it's a bit insane.
Sweet.
But it's,
see, I always think it's kind of slutty.
Okay. But she's just expressing herself, and she's just friendly, that's all. Anyway, this song makes me feel much more confident that I'm okay with Call Me Maybe, because this one's catchy in that way that is really mechanical. It's really sort of custom built, and it's actually like, I've been listening to a few things today, and it's basically custom built out of Marvin Gaye, out of a Marvin Gaye song, and but it just sounds, it's just got a similar sort of ramshackle feel to it. And Depeche Mode's a song by Depeche Mode, and I'll get to it in a second, but that's why it's catchy. But at the same time, the video is the most cynical thing I've ever seen. There's loads of naked ladies, they're strewn over him, he looks like David Brent if David Brent was a bit younger and a bit better looking but more orange, and he carries himself like David Brent when David Brent's being a pop star. It's just like creepy.
What, he does that embarrassing dance thing?
He doesn't do the dance, he just does that, lots of looks to the camera, and oh, it's horrible. And I was pinned under a baby. I couldn't change the channel, and I kind of knew that on the other channel there was a really depressing advert. The reason I turned on to this, I appreciate this doesn't make me sound very good, but there's this advert they keep showing on the TV channels that my wife leaves on the television about a little girl who has an illness, and they're trying to raise money for her. And I've watched it the first few times, and now I just can't anymore because it upsets me too much. So okay. I flicked over, but I literally went up one channel, and it was this music channel with that. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I can't change the channel. But this guy is just basically talking about date rape over and over again.
The thing that really confused me about the Robin Thicke performance at the VMAs of Miley Cyrus was he was dressed as Beetlejuice for some reason.
That's weird.
And it was just like, I don't know, that whole performance made me feel a bit sick.
I think there's a possibility that at his core, he thinks he's quirky rather than douchey. And his quirk is he's pretending to be douchey, but the truth is it doesn't matter because he comes across as so douchey. And the other thing is, the video, while the video's going, every few seconds in big red letters, it'll be hashtag Robin Thicke. In big letters across the middle, hashtag blurred lines. And that's the most cynical thing I've ever seen.
I hate it when they do it in TV programs. Like, you start, I noticed they did a lot in Fringe, but you'd start it, you'd be watching it, and you'd just have this hashtag, I can't remember.
Fringe, or hashtag where's Pacey. That's not his name. That's the actor's name. It's not the character's name.
Where's Peter?
Peter's his name. Mm-hmm. The actor's called Pacey, the character's called Peter.
No, I think the actor's called Joshua.
Okay.
But he
that
is
That seems
Pacey.
Like a made-up name to
he,
me.
He is Pacey, let's face it.
Yes. But that's normally just in the bottom left-hand corner. In this, it's like really big, like it's advertising lard or something. It's just gigantic. It's not fucking about, and it's...
Sorry, I just kicked the table because you made me laugh.
I thought you hit your head on the mic. That was funny. And it's just so ostentatious and annoying, and I don't know. I don't understand how it got to number one, except the problem is I do understand how it got to number one, and it makes me sad.
Well, the reason it got to number one is because all you need to get to number one these days is to sell about 12 singles.
Just Can't Get Enough by Depeche Mode.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
the other ingredient. Dum, dum, da, dum, dum, da, dum, dum, da, dum. That's in it. That's the hook in Just Can't Get Enough. And it's also in, it occurs to me every time I do that I know exactly what I'm doing in my head. But because I'm
say,
a bit tone deaf, it comes across and it just... It's just a guy
just
going,
can't get enough to me.
Dumb, 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 dumb. Which I think was the hook to another Depeche Mode song, but I can't remember which one. Enjoy the silence. This is the Momcast. You can write to us or send us some contributions. There should be contributions on this show. People have promised us them this week, so I'm sure they will turn up because people never lie. But you can send us audio contributions 2 to 5 minutes about comics, anything about comics. You can be reviewing a comic of the week or a graphic novel you've read, a trade paper graphic novel you've read, or just talking about comic book films or adaptations or whatever you want. It's fine. Just please send us stuff, because it seems like people who are normally on this show are hardly ever on this show anymore, and we have loads of time to fill. 2 to 5 minutes of audio or emails about anything else. We especially like things about growing your penis extra long, to momcast@gmail.com. That's mombcast@gmail.com. You can talk to me on Twitter at Nick's site. You can talk to John on Twitter at
John Momb
with no H. And you can talk to Jane on Twitter at Jane Momb. And there's the Mom Comics account, that's the main account, and that's sometimes where you'll see stuff from our Tumblr. Our Tumblr has pictures on it, it's quite nice. That's on Tumblr. You can see links to us on Tumblr and Facebook and Google+. They're all on the top right hand of momcomics.com, which is the main website. You can also subscribe to us in your podcatcher of choice, and if you want to review, leave a review on iTunes. That's apparently really good for us, but we just kind of like you to comment on our site as well if you like the episode and stuff. It's nice to have a conversation with people. It's good.
Fine.
It's kind of nice anyway, I think. I mean, it's okay. Sometimes people are idiots, but most of the people who listen to this show aren't, we've discovered.
No, all the people that listen to this show are lovely.
All 7 of them. The people on the show are assholes, though, but that's besides the point. Shall we talk about comics?
Yes, let's.
Tell me, why did it have to be Michael Giorgio? When he reviews comics, oh my God, doesn't he go on? When he writes comic books, they are really very good. But when he reviews, he makes me crave death. Michael Giorgio.
Thanks, James. This week I was recommended to read Thor, God of Thunder, issue 12 by 2 people. So this week I shall be talking about Station to Station by Karina Bechko and Gabriel Hardman. Now, this comic wigged me out a bit, mainly because I've been listening to a lot of Night Vale lately, and Well, I'll just describe it. A scientist wakes up battered and bruised after an explosion takes out most of Treasure Island by San Francisco Bay. As he wakes up to see a weird crab-type beetle thing nibbling at his arm. Whatever has happened at the laboratory has made monsters appear on the island, from dinosaurs to giant floaty tentacle monsters that will make any hentai fan happy. Right, after fighting a crocodile, as you do, the scientist and his colleague try to rebuild the machine to send the monster back where it came from. This is a one-shot story, which basically means that there are no other stories before or after it. The art is more realistic than cartoony, which helps anchor the rather bizarre story, throwing browns and pastel shades on humanity and monsters alike. Flashbacks are red and pink, while the borders of the panel seem to crackle with electricity. While the ending does leave you with a sense of dread, filled with a, you know, the classic "the end?" question mark at the end, it feels like a complete story. It's got a nice War of the Worlds feel to it, and while I think it could carry on the story, I think it works just as well as it is. And that's it. I'll come back to you either with more comics or Elemental Mike and news, but till then, it was ice to see you. Oh, that's terrible.
Mm-hmm. I'm feeling a bit hyper. Anyway, sorry.
It's that coffee you've had, isn't it? It's that caffeine that's gotten to you.
What comic have you got there, sorry?
First of all, I have got Cyborg Superman issue 1, which is actually Action Comics 23.1, because I'm not sure
because
why
you
DC
don't know.
Have done this.
Because reasons.
I'm sure that Marvel will probably sue them for stealing the point one thing.
The back cover's lenticular as well.
Yeah, the back cover is a sort of advert for Arkham Origins. It's looks quite cool. But yeah, the cover to this is 3D, and I buy Action Comics anyway because I just enjoy it. But this issue is just a standalone story that revolves around the creation of the Cyborg Superman, who obviously first appeared after the death of Superman.
But then, not in this continuity.
No, not in this continuity, the other continuity. Or the one before the other, I don't know.
No, I think it was the last continuity.
I can't remember, I get confused with the continuities.
It's not just you, buddy. Can I just clarify to the listener, the cover isn't actually 3D, it's what we'd call lenticular, I guess.
It looks 3D.
Which is like you used to get...
it's not, it's a visual illusion.
You used to, when people used to eat cereal in the mornings, you used to sometimes get these, like, little stickers and stuff that were lenticular in the 1980s. But apparently it's still sufficiently advanced that we're all impressed when it's on our covers now.
Well, the thing is, if this was the 1990s, this would just be any random issue of a comic.
Pretty much all of them.
Pretty much, since that nearly killed comics as we know it, people don't do that anymore, except for special occasions, of which apparently the issue 23.1 is one such occasion, or the fact that it's DC's Villains Month. But I don't know why it's Villains Month, I have to admit.
It's much harder to hide, for example, an inability to draw feet behind rocks when you're playing with more than two dimensions is a thing.
That is true, but the feet on this look okay. Actually, they look a bit weird, but that's not because they're too small. They're actually perfectly in scale.
Comics were great in the 1990s. There were loads of great comics in the 1990s, kids. It's just those aren't the ones that people like to talk about. So, Villains Month, I think the reason they've done it is because they wanted to give people migraines one way or another, mainly comic retailers when ordering, but now everyone else who's trying to look at the shelves.
It is also worth pointing out that if you don't like lenticular covers, you can get them in a non-lenticular standard format.
Yes.
The story for this issue is a standalone story as it revolves around the creation of the Cyborg Superman and basically where he came from. I'm not sure how much of this is already known, and I don't really want to spoil it because it basically revolves around his creation, and then Brainiac sends the Cyborg Superman flying around the universe to find people like him that are perfect, so that he can transform them. And
but they're perfect.
Well, they need to be perfect for Brainiac to make them perfect by his standard.
Perfecter. When he flies around the universe, does he keep flying around the universe until everyone in the universe goes back in time?
No.
Then it's not Superman, as far as I'm concerned. Sorry, carry on.
Well, of course it's not. It's
such
the Cyborg
a
Superman.
Mood. What is going on?
But basically, yeah, he flies around and he gets involved with some alien races and basically just has a lot of fights with all of them. It, like I say, it's quite hard to discuss what goes on without giving away what I think is actually a rather nice, neat little story.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I, or the reason I buy Action Comics on a month-by-month basis, well, I started out buying it because of the Morrison run, but that finished, and I expected to stop buying it at that point, but I kind of carried on because the Andy Diggle stuff was entertaining, and I quite enjoyed the Scott Lobdell? Yeah.
Hmm.
His sort of few issues on it were good. And this one, which, if I'm completely honest, I don't know who it's by or who drew it, so I should probably find out.
Do that now.
I am doing
the listener
it now.
Will wait. They don't mind. They're patient. They have to be.
And I apologise if I keep banging the issue against the desk. It's because the cover's slightly heavier than usual.
It's all fine. I'll edit all this out.
Okay. This was written by Michael Alan Nelson and drawn by Mike Hawthorne.
This is the back. Is this the story at the back? Or this is the actual
no,
story?
No, it is actually. This is just one story. And it... I think it's quite a nice little story. It's a neat way of explaining the cyborg Superman's existence. It actually puts some surprising depth into the character, and it kind of, I don't know, it's just an interesting little story. But the reason I buy Action Comics is because I like the fact that I can read a Superman story without actually having to worry about the continuity.
Yeah.
One of the whole things I remember about when I was a kid and I used to read comics was that I would go and pick up a comic, and very often I'll have no idea. Like, if it was part two of four, then it was part two of four. I just had to try and find part one of four. And I just used to pick them up and read them. And the actual sense of continuity and all what's going on here never actually really bothered me that much. So having something like Action Comics where I can just go and pick it up and go, oh, what's Superman doing in this? It's not even how does this tie into next month or something. It's just what's he doing? Oh, here's an adventure where he flies around and punches a dragon in the teeth. It's pretty good for that. And that's kind of why I like Action Comics. But I will say that, I don't know, this issue, if you're reading Action Comics, you're going to pick the issue up anyway. If you're not, it's not exactly a game changer that's going to make comics completely reinvented, but it's an entertaining 22 pages, and I did enjoy the story and the way it explains Cyborg's origin.
Is he in the DC 52? I mean, has he been a player in the DC 52 already? Has he shown up?
I don't know.
Not sure?
The only books I buy the DC 52 are Action Comics and I think Dial H for Hero.
Uh-huh.
So I have no idea what goes on in the regular continuity.
And, well, of course, it's worth noting, if you're a comic publisher, because I know they listen, that although that what John is saying is, I think, and John will correct me if I'm wrong, but he's saying that the reason he picks up Action Comics is because it's easy to pick up and he doesn't need to be worrying about continuity.
Yep.
But I think he's also saying that he's picked up all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So
not as far back as 1937.
No, but I mean,
because
you picked
I wasn't
up,
alive then.
But you picked up all of the DC 52, all of this run, haven't you?
Of this run of Action Comics, yes.
Yeah, which is interesting, because you could, strictly speaking, have followed the continuity. Like, if it had been, what I'm saying is, I think part of the reason the comics have so much continuity is to kind of push people to come back every month.
Yeah.
But you're coming back every month.
Because I can just read random. I think you're it's good
reading
to have random stories.
Yeah, for sure. But you're reading a book that you're reading a book on the premise that you could dip into this book if you wanted to.
Yes, that's
but
it.
Because you enjoy the experience, you've ended up picking up all of them anyway.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I'm bending myself, I'm tying myself in knots, but that's interesting to me.
No, that is pretty much why I pick it up, because it's a continuity-free book. All you need to know, read Action Comics, is that Superman is Superman, and that's it.
He's a bloke.
Yeah, and you can kind of, it alludes to certain other aspects in the new 52, and that's fine, because you can kind of just grab onto it and go, right, well, that's sort of alluding to this, that's fine.
We've talked about it we talked about it before. I'm not sure if it's been when you've been on the show, but it's the difference between a shared universe and a continuity porn or continuity driven stuff.
Yep.
When you read Marvel Comics, when you read DC Comics, when you read Marvel Comics in the 80s and the 70s, even in a big crossover book like Secret Wars or something, Secret Wars is a bad example, and Secret Wars 2 is probably the start of these really intertwined stories where you had to read loads of different stuff to get the whole thing.
Yeah.
But someone would refer to having met a character before, you'd get a little editor's note of which comic it was in, but that'd be it, and you wouldn't need any more than that. And what you got was a sense that this was a shared universe, and that made it feel like it was part of something bigger without you actually having to spend hundreds of months just to get everything. And and I don't know if it's possible really to get back. Well, it sounds like what you're saying about that is that's what that book feels like, which is good. I know that it's one of those things that maybe in a lot of cases that genie's kind of out the bottle, because a lot of people don't know how to make comics like that anymore. And people don't know how to read comics like that anymore, because the last time comics were like that was before an awful lot of people who are reading comics now were born.
Yep.
So, but I don't know. I liked it. It felt more back then like you were buying comics that were referred to because you were interested to find out more rather than because you felt you had to. And so you didn't end up resenting the outlay.
Yeah.
Really. Okay. Well, that's Action Comics sounding good then.
Okay.
I read the first issue of it and quite liked it, but then didn't pick up any others. So.
Oh, what is that? The Morrison run?
Yeah, the Morrison one.
I was considering I'm such a hardcore Morrison fan. I was really, really left cold by his run on Action Comics. And I think I summed it up to you with the problem I have with Morrison's run on Action Comics is that, all right, if Morrison was indeed kidnapped by aliens, as he says he may have been in his book and whatever, and he's spoken about many times, and they took him to a place which was outside of time in the fifth dimension or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's lovely that he knows how to write in a way that sort of works in the fifth dimension, but the rest of us haven't been kidnapped and taken there, so we don't understand how that works. And I get what he was trying to do with it, and I think in places he really hit some high notes, but I also think it just left me a bit cold.
I read All-Star Superman a little bit after the fact, and to me it kind of felt like I'd read the Morrison Superman that I really wanted to, and so it seemed like a retroactive step to go back to this this grounded in the DC Universe version of it, and I don't know. Anyway, me thrashing out my problems with the DC 52 yet again probably isn't a great idea, and we'll probably be talking about something else in there in a bit anyway. So
okay, anyway, next up I've been reading Suicide Risk issue 5 by Mike Carey and Joelle Jones. This is really good because they put the names on the cover, so
which is handy, you don't have to pull it out there. Excellent.
That's from Boom Studios. Suicide Risk is a story that's set in a universe where superpowers have only just sort of started to become a thing, and most of the people that have them aren't using them for good. And the main character is a police officer called Leo Tillman, who basically, after seeing one of his friends get crippled, tries to hunt down the source of these superpowers and where they're coming from. This issue in particular is actually a standalone issue, and it has what I call the Mike Carey issue 5 jump, which is where for the past 4 issues he's been focusing on this character and basically just following him, hunting down these people. He ends up with his own superpowers, and the basic thing with it is is that when you get given superpowers in this universe, you'll either take and they'll sort of put themselves on you and you'll have superpowers and it'll be amazing, or you'll die.
Right.
And you don't know until you try. Mm-hmm. So basically, that's your suicide risk.
Right, okay.
And
that's interesting.
Basically, this issue in particular revolves around the story of a housewife who, being quite stressed out with her life, ends up basically giving somebody rather a lot of money and gaining superpowers as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it runs along like a perfectly standalone story.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, finds a way to neatly tie itself back into the previous four issues in a way that makes you go, oh, he's going somewhere with this, which is pretty much what he did with Unwritten.
Right. Is the Mike Carey effect for Mike Carey, what did you call it?
The Mike Carey issue 5 effect. I'm sure I called it something different. But
Is it like the first four issues are introducing you to the world through the eyes of, in a buttoned down way, through one character, maybe through a very limited character who's on a quest.
Mm-hmm.
So you're introduced to this and you don't know if it's just going to be following this one character like I think Chu does for the rest of the run. I don't know, that's unfair, that was just a dig, because I don't read Chu. And then at the fifth issue, it suddenly all opens up and you realise this is going to be the scope of this series is going to be bigger.
Well, he's already been hinting at the scope being bigger at the end of issue 4, mm-hmm. because it went places I completely didn't see it going. With issue 5, it's a much more focused in, very much pared down story, and it is literally just the final couple of panels that make you go, oh, this is something different. And the thing I like with Suicide Risk in particular is that there's actually quite a lot of good interactions between families in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a book about families and people that work hard to effectively pay for their families and to sort of provide for their families. And it's just kind of, it's almost very sort of like blue collar working class, just with superpowers thrown into the mix and lots of other crazy stuff. I really like Mike Carey, so I was pretty much going to buy this book, whatever. But I think this is the point where it's starting to show its hand a bit more. And I think it's definitely worth following. I've been really enjoying it, though. But like I say, I'm a huge Mike Carey fan, so I could be a bit sort of biased. But I think it's worth reading.
Joel Jones, I like. I think I've seen her work on a couple of those Minx books that DC did. So she's really good, isn't she?
This is her first issue on the book. Yeah. There was, I can't remember who the other artist was, wasn't it? It was another female artist, and her work was really good. What's good is that the fact that Joel Jones is doing this standalone story, I don't know if she's now going to carry on and do more, but it means that it doesn't interfere with the telling of the story. And what you get is, it still feels like it fits the story perfectly. And it's a really, like, her artwork is really good in this issue. And I really like a lot of the dynamics in this issue in particular. The main character in this issue, who is the overworked housewife, turns into a fantastic sort of superpowered person,
mm-hmm.
and what she ends up doing with those powers is brilliant,
mm-hmm.
and it has an absolutely, so there's a great scene towards the end where you think she goes into a room and you think she's going to do one thing and she does the complete opposite, and it's such a sort of, oh, okay. But you realise, like, at first it seems like a surprise, but when you look back at it, you realise that the whole book's been leading up to that, and actually it's been really, really cleverly and neatly forecast, but you just haven't realised it, and that's because the telling of the story's been so good. But no, the artwork is brilliant, and it's well worth picking up. I'd say that at this point, you've probably got a good jumping on point. So this might be, like, if you're sort
this
of
a good
you've seen it on the shelves and you thought, oh, I wonder, but no, it's on issue 2 or 3, this is probably the point where it's worth getting on board.
What you refer to as the Mike Carey effect, I'm quite interested in that, and I won't dwell on it too much, but I really think of it's something I first noticed. It's a good way to launch series, and it's something I first noticed with Sandman, so I've always kind of related it to that. But Transmetropolitan does it, and Preacher does it as well, and I guess Mike Carey probably did it with Lucifer, and
yeah.
it works as a way to you start with a small story where sometimes the stakes are a bit smaller and you just introduce people to the world that way rather than throwing everything at people at once. And I actually think with Sandman, I know that that first book sometimes gets criticised a little bit retrospectively now for being a bit like not that unusual, and I don't think people like the art very much. People talk about the book really coming alive with the Doll's House, but I think what people are under failing to really get a hold of with that is that most that book might not have had a chance to survive if it had started with the heavily structured, really beautifully drawn but quite like unusual. It started out looking like a horror comic, like an old-fashioned horror comic, and the story had those tropes, but it was also a really simple, quite small story about, well, it was the scale was huge, but it was about a guy that you'd just been introduced to who was going around trying to collect things. It's like fairly straightforward fairy story structure. He's got these artifacts he has to collect, and it's similar to like he's trying to solve the mystery of his partner's, like of the thing that killed his partner, and that thing, those are all quite, the stakes are quite small, and you can get hold of that. I don't think people would have been able to get hold of a story of the scale of Sandman if they'd been thrown straight into the Doll's House.
The thing I find with Sandman, I think, is that it's the first book is also set in the DC continuity, and then the second one very much steps out of that and it becomes its own world. And I think that was because I think at the time they thought it was just going to be like any other DC book, and then they realised that it didn't really fit. And I actually quite like the first volume. It's probably
I really do. One I mean, I pored over those comics lots because when it was coming out, I don't know if you were reading it, if you're old enough to have been reading it when it was coming out.
I didn't start reading it until I was about 16, and that was when I found random volumes in the library. And the thing was, because they were just the old volumes, they didn't have the numbering on them, so once again I would just pick up a book and I had no idea. And it was the first time I remember actually realizing there was a continuity behind the stories that was actually important. And so I actually had to stop reading it and start trying to find the first volume and then find out what the second one was. And this was before the internet, so I had no idea how to find that out.
But I guess you were still at the point there where you didn't have access to loads of comics, so when you borrowed one of the books from the library, you probably read it several times, right?
Yeah.
Because whenever you're reading one of those books, it's really useful to consider that the first book of Sandman, and we are going off the point, and we will get back onto it in a second, because you could talk about Sandman for hours. You could, I could, we both could.
Yep.
When you read the books, the first people now kind of think about the first book as it, you read it really quickly and then you're on to the next volume, and maybe it's an evening. But when you're buying those as comics in very real terms, that represents, I can't remember how many, was it 5 issues? It represents like 5 or 6 months worth of this comic that you end up reading and rereading and rereading because you didn't have loads of other comics to read. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of lived with those comics for a while, and I was so sad when Sam Keefe left that book. But that's besides the point. My point is that, and it works with Transmetropolitan as well. The first book of Transmetropolitan is you're being introduced to this crazy world through the eyes of the returning
Spidey Jerusalem.
The returning hermit or whatever. which is a kind of a quite classic structure to a story. The first book of Preacher kind of
is almost very very different to the others, and it's
quite a tight sort of,
yeah, it's much more self-contained. And I think,
well, it's like to be honest, it's structured like a joke. A girl, a guy, and a vampire walk into that's how it starts, doesn't it? It starts in a diner.
I can't believe that all the times I've read Preacher, and I've never once thought of that. And now you mention it, I'm absolutely gobsmacked, because you're right.
If I'm remembering right, it starts in a diner. Your first scene, there are these three characters, you don't know anything about them, but they're all very distinctive, and you start to learn stuff about them as you go. And but it starts with that. It doesn't start trying to tell you, this is going to be a book about,
The one thing that really bugs me about Preacher is that, because obviously when you read the blurb on the back of the first volume or going into it, I knew that Cassidy was a vampire. But that moment where you first find out he's a vampire, when they're having the fight outside the motel or something, and Jesse turns around and Cassidy's just got the guy and he's like ripped his neck open, his blood dripping off his fangs, he's like, what? Just that really sort of like, if I'd have been reading that in a monthly comic, that scene would have absolutely floored me.
Garth Ennis really knows how to write monthly comics.
Yeah.
I'm not always entirely sure that the sprawl ends up being worth it. But when you're locked into one of those books, yeah, he knows how to deliver the first page, he knows how to deliver the last page and the scenes in between. It's really good. Mike Carey, I've always found kind of quiet. I read the Lucifer. I didn't read Lucifer in singles, and I did read it in trade. I think I read a lot of it in trades. And he's a much more satisfying book read than comics read. Is that the case with Suicide Risk as well?
It does make sense when you read it more together. What surprised me with Suicide Risk is about issue 3-4. It goes off on such a completely insane tangent that feels all of a sudden you get this real sense of scale of the universe that this world is set in. And it's quite clever because you're seeing it always through the eyes of this protagonist, this cop, and he's as completely baffled by it as you are. And he's got no idea what's going on. He just kind of rolls with it and does what he has to because he has to survive. And you kind of just sit there and it's like, it's a really impressive way that he's handling it, because it's like I say, the actual character building and the way that he always continually comes back to the families and the element of providing for your family really sort of works. But he set it against some of the most insanely large scale stuff in the opening issues, and I don't feel like he's sort of, it was quite a surprising sort of place for it to go. But I'm really curious to see where he's going to go next, because I don't think he's necessarily going to get bigger. I think he's just going to continue like chipping away at the big mystery in this book, which is, where do the powers come from? These superpowers that everyone's getting, where do they come from? Like, you've seen how people get them, but you don't actually know what it is that gives them the power or why it's happened to the Earth now. And that's kind of what drives the story. But he doesn't feel the need to reiterate that in every single issue. It's just an underlying question that's always there. And every time you just sort of start to drift off and forget about it, he's sort of realise that this is the point where his reader will probably start to drift off and forget about it, and just puts in a gentle reminder, which is exactly what this issue does, because the past two issues haven't really focused that much on sort of the people getting the powers. It's been a lot more large scale stuff, and you come back to it and it's just like, oh, here's this really sort of like kitchen sink story about this woman and what happens to her, and it's a really really good little issue. It's a really nice single issue.
Cool. Okay, so what else you got? You've got Superior Spider-Man now. I can see it. I am behind a few issues on this.
Oh, dear. Oh, this is a good one.
What issue is it now?
Great issue. Issue 17. Mm-hmm. It's by Dan Slott and Brian Stegman. It's been hinted at for a while now. I think everyone's pretty aware that the Spider-Man of 2099 was going to turn up at some point. And this is the issue where he turns up. It's the first part of at least a two-parter. I'll admit, I'm hoping that it's more like a six or seven-parter, because this is a great issue.
Dan Slott churns through stories really quickly, though.
Yeah,
like
I
big,
know.
Big stories.
I reckon this will be like a two, mm-hmm. maybe three-parter at push. However, I think it's great. I think this issue, it basically revolves around some sort of time travel Gubbins displacement thing that happens in the Marvel Universe of 2099, and the Spider-Man of 2099 sets in to deal with it, and basically then sort of through his arch rival has to go back in time and deal with what's causing this anomaly.
Does it tie into the age of the end of Age of Ultron?
It wasn't
one of the flashes you got at the end of, I don't know if you read
I didn't read Age of Ultron. I don't know if it does, but I think this is more just a random sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to have any larger universe implications, but one of the things I like about it is that it was only about a year ago that I read Peter David's run on Spider-Man 2099,
mm-hmm.
which I loved. And the thing that's really good with Slott is that Slott, in the few scenes he writes in 2099, just seems to have a complete handle on it instantly,
mm-hmm.
and knows how to write it. And all it's made me want is a Dan Slott mini series of Spider-Man 2099. I know that's probably wishful thinking, mm-hmm. but God, I want it. But one of the things that I really like about where Slott is taking Superior Spider-Man is he is really looking deeply at the ethics of Otto Octavius and what he thinks is right.
Mm-hmm.
We've had hints in previous issues where he's let very minor things slip by, just as a kind of sort of, he's just ignored it because it's not big scale enough mm-hmm. for him. Because he can design all these amazing bits of technology and do so much. And I can't work out whether it's balancing out an ethic of, well, these are the low-level crimes and they're not hurting anyone, or is it he's just ignoring them, where Spider-Man wouldn't. But one of the things, there is a scene in this where Spider-Man goes after somebody based entirely on the fact that his spider sense goes off,
mm-hmm.
and that's his reasoning, and that's what makes, and it is literally Otto Octavius says, oh, I'm going to go and get this guy because he set off my spider sense.
Must have done something
that's
wrong.
All, yeah, that's all the reason I need, yeah. And it's a brilliant moment because it's like, well, hang on, it kind of, I think the way Slott has written Otto as Spider-Man works so well. The softball game at the beginning of this issue is fantastic, and it says everything you need to know about Otto as a character and reminds you of why you hate him. But at the same time, you can't help but love him somewhat, because you are just there thinking, how has nobody else noticed that this is someone different?
It's like gradations of rooting for people. It's good. I've thought this about some of the TV I watch. Like, we watch Scandal a bit, and also Homeland at times. But really, I'm thinking about Scandal. There are very few really good guys in Scandal, but there are very few really bad guys as well. The good thing about Superior Spider-Man and about shows like that is, it's not that you specifically want anyone. If you're supposed to care about a character at all, you have to kind of want them to win out against at least somebody. You kind of want, the thing I found about the issues of Superior Spider-Man I read, because like I said, I'm a few issues behind, I liked all of them, is the fact that you don't like Otto beating Peter And in the back of your mind, you do kind of, unless you're a sociopath, probably still want Peter to win. The slightly problematic thing, actually, about that book that I found quite quickly is, well, I realised really early on that at this point, the consequence of Peter Parker winning, the consequence of Peter Parker coming back, the way the story's been laid out, is that Otto Octavius will die. That he'll only one of them gets to live. There's only one body. So unless there's something else going on, and it is the Marvel Universe, so anything could happen, really. But that's the downside. And once I realised that was the choice you were having to make, I was like, well, but I kind of like Otto Octavius now. And it's sort of when he's having the little relationship with fellow student at the university, you kind of do want that to work out for him. He's not being a creep. He genuinely likes her, and she genuinely seems to like him. And he's not conning anybody, because she didn't know Peter Parker before. He's just being him. So it's kind of, and it ties in all of those odd ideas where you've had in the past where he did genuinely love Aunt May. A real super proper supervillain wouldn't have. Do you know what I mean? He's evil, but evil in a way that isn't entirely, I'm evil because I'm like the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Yeah, strictly speaking, Magneto didn't think he was evil, did he? He thought he was right. Well, why did he call them the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants?
Again, I've never considered that, which is odd, because Magneto is my favourite mutant.
I think that observation was made somewhere else. But still, it's kind of... It's that sort of thing, and the good thing about... And it's the same in Justified as well, and in Scandal and stuff like that. If a baddie character... If a villainous character or one of the protagonist's enemies is written properly or well enough, then you don't want them... There's a hierarchy of who you know. They get to be taken out by the good guy. They don't get to be taken out by some crappy enemy who's just turned. They don't get to be taken out by one of the henchmen, because you kind of want them. You want them to win within a certain context. I probably need to think about this.
And I think one of the things that I like is that Superior Spider-Man, like, there was a part of me when it started that thought, yeah, this will be 12 months and we'll be back on to Peter. And it's not. It's issue 17 now, even though it's double shipping, isn't it?
So it's not been a year. It started January, didn't it, I think?
But it manages to evoke enough sympathy for Otto that you do genuinely care for him and you want him to succeed. But every once in a while, like in the moment with this, in the softball game, you just remember that this guy's a bit of a jerk. Like, okay.
Oh yeah, but I mean, I can sum up what I just said in like a much more straightforward, familiar way, and that's the term, he's an arsehole, but he's our arsehole. That's essentially like, there was a time in comics where the fact that Flash Thompson was bullying Peter Parker was enough of a reason for you to just want to see him die in a fire. You didn't really care about him getting to succeed in his own way. Do you know what I mean? But that's, we're past that point now, and it's good, because that book does make you think harder about what you want to happen, or it should do. It should make you think harder about what you want to happen to the characters, because you're getting to relate to or empathize with characters that
you wouldn't normally get the chance to.
And that's just good writing.
Yeah. And that's the thing that sort of gets me, is people are like, oh, you know, you should bring back Peter Parker. And I'm like, well, they're going to bring him back at some point, because it's comics, and they will.
Well, even if they
I'm enjoying this. I'm really enjoying this, and having this issue in particular, the fact that it builds up to a point at the end where it does the atypical comics thing where next month you get the Spider-Man of now against the Spider-Man of 86 years from now. It's like, okay, cool.
But is it 86? I mean, does that work? Because has enough time passed in the Marvel Universe since the 2099 comics were launched?
Well, no, it's the Spider-Man of now, which is Otto, and the Spider-Man of 86 years from now, which is the Spider-Man of 2099.
In our world?
Yeah, but it does actually say is 2013. They make reference to that in the book.
See, that's really weird, though, because has enough time passed since the Marvel Universe when 20... Because when was 2099 launched?
That was mid-90s, I think.
Because comics don't move in real time, do they?
Okay,
no, it might that might have been 1990. That might have been 1995, and we might be in 2013 now. But that doesn't mean that Peter Parker has aged 8 years.
No, but for the not sake 8 years, of this story, 20,
however many years
for this for the sake years. Of this story, because all they need to do is set the date so you know how far in the future 2099 is, and they have. It's 86 years.
It's timey-wimey.
It's not wibbly wobbly though. It's pretty straightforward.
Listener, I know that 1995 wasn't actually 8 years ago. I got really confused by the maths.
I completely didn't even twig that you said that, and now I'm like, what? Hang on.
It's nearly 20 years.
Yes, I
know. And Peter Parker hasn't aged 20 years in the intervening time, has he?
No, he's aged
about three or four years.
Yeah.
Although there's been more than 3 or 4 years worth of story, so it's very confusing. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, John. I must apologise.
Hello, monkeys. It's Mike again. And I'm here, even though I wasn't going to, I'm going to give my thoughts of Thor, God of Thunder, issue 12. Yeah, a lot of people recommended this to me, and because it was quite a sort of a sweet story. And yeah, I read it, and it was sweet. And yeah, it had Thor sort of helping people out when he's not going around godding it up the place. He gives someone on death row a rare fruit and counsels someone with cancer, and he goes on a date with a girl who requested to go on a date with him on YouTube. You know what, Thor? You're a git. That's what you are. You're just making it look bad for the rest of us. Going around, swanning about with your flipping hammer, you know, being gorgeous and sort of drinking mead and, you know, I've had enough, you know. Why can't you just be a dickhead? Because then I would like you. Instead, you're just swanning about with your arms and... duh. Yeah. And that's what I thought of issue 12. Okay, thank you. Bye.
I'm going to talk about my comics now. I'm going to try and be really brief. John and I apparently always end up going off and doing almost an offshooty thing where we just talk about the history of comics as we understand it, really, rather than talking about the comics we're talking about. X-Men Legacy number 16, written by Simon Spurrier, with art by Paul Davidson and colours by Rachel Rosenberg or Rachel Rosenberg. The previous issue, for various reasons, saw David Haller finally deciding to go after Cyclops, who killed his father. And this issue is about that.
Hang on,
you're looking at me funny.
Killed.
Professor X.
Did he?
Did you not know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay, well, I've just spoiled Avengers versus X-Men, A versus X, but go and read the wiki page, John. Not right now, read it after. And then come back to me
That's the most interesting thing Cyclops has done in years.
Oh, he's been a complete douchebag for years and years. Okay, and so this issue is basically Legion, although apparently he doesn't like that name. It's David Haller encountering the uncanny X-Men as are now. So Cyclops, the White Queen, Magneto, and the other people that they've managed to collect together around them. It's a fight comic, but it isn't just a fight comic. David Haller and through him Simon Spurrier come up with some interesting ways to handle characters like Magneto and Cyclops, not just in terms of their characterization, but in terms of how, if you're a psychic, you deal with, how, if you're a world-class psychic, you deal with a guy who wears a psychic-proof helmet, just stuff like that. So there's characterization. It's interesting because there's characterization going on that's really, really good, a really nice version of these characters, or a really sort of deep version of these characters, while at the same time quite inventive, super-powered characters fighting each other and encountering each other. It is a totally grounded in the Marvel Universe comic. There's no getting around that. It's one super-powered person, like in a fight with another bunch of guys who have their own books. And you know, you adjust the stakes in your head accordingly when it comes to that,
depending on which book you're reading.
But it's the characterization's really nice, the art's really nice. And you know, I'm already kind of sold on this book anyway. It's always clever. The interesting thing about it that I felt was sometimes this book can feel like the mutant book that hates mutant books, or within the X universe, it's quite subversive. It doesn't exist to poke fun at the conventions of it. But when David Haller is pulled out of his own personal journey, which is quite interesting in itself, and forced to deal with like Wolverine's team, or in this case Cyclops' team, or the Red Skull, or whatever, it's very irreverent. It can be very irreverent about those characters in a way that I don't find impossible to read alongside of the books that love those characters. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of, it's an interesting view, and it fits with David Haller's view of these characters because he's always been the outsider. It goes quite easy on the Uncanny X-Men compared to what I was expecting. It isn't all quips at their expense, possibly because David Haller is supposed to be, he isn't just encountering them because he can't avoid them. He has gone after Cyclops. He's not really in the mood to take the piss out of him because he's angry with the guy. But at the same time, it's really easy to write Cyclops as an actual malevolent douchebag at the moment, and he only really gets written as a douchebag in this. There is a point where he says to David Haller, to David, don't you want me to explain to you what happened about his father dying? And the response is, no, not really. And at that point, you're thinking, well, I know who the bad guy in this is, but it's like any other situation. When someone's that angry, when someone's that intent on violent retribution, they become the arsehole. Even if they're completely justified, it's hard not to become the arsehole in that situation. And it's interesting because Legion gets to be the unreasonable one in this. At this point, he gets to be the unreasonable character.
Because is he the main character in this?
Oh, yeah. X-Men Legacy is about him. I mean, X-Men Legacy is, I've always thought that's quite interesting. The title, I think, wasn't this the book that Chris Claremont wrote? I don't know. I think X-Men Legacy used to refer to the fact that it was the Legacy team.
Yeah, wasn't this, Claremont wrote like 3 issues of it and then it got canned?
It might not have been this, because Mike Carey, I think, wrote X-Men Legacy for a while.
Yeah, because it crossed over with the event that I've forgotten the name of.
But it was kind of the one that looked backwards most of the 90s and was that sort of storytelling. But now it means, Haller is the offspring of Professor X, who is where the X-Men
dream came from.
So effectively he's the Legacy, and that's what it means. And it's quite interesting because it's a completely different book from what it was before, but the title still makes sense.
It's an interesting one though, because didn't David Haller effectively once kill his father already, because that caused the Age of Apocalypse?
Yeah,
it was an accident, but
yeah, but I mean, he's his dad to kill.
Yeah, okay,
I think, you know,
well, obviously he didn't mean to, but
speaking of legacies, The that's so shit. I'm sorry, everyone. I'm really sorry. I was reading the Brian Wood Carl Ostander Star Wars comic for a little bit, and I was really enjoying it, but it turns out I don't like the thing about Star Wars comics is they always appeal to me initially, and then I remember that I've gone off Star Wars after a while. So I think that's pretty much one of the best Star Wars comics you could possibly get if you're into Star Wars.
Yeah.
What came out this week, which is a really interesting exercise, a really peculiar and interesting exercise, was for $3.99 from Dark Horse Comics, the first issue of The Star Wars, based on George Lucas's original rough draft screenplay. It says at the bottom, longer ago, in a galaxy even further away, that is not either geographically or temporally entirely accurate. The galaxy isn't even further away. It's just a different version of the same galaxy. It is longer ago in terms of when it was written, though, originally. That much is true. The blurb in the front says, back in 1974, still years before a film called Star Wars would take the world by storm, and even longer before George Lucas would then ruin those films, George Lucas completed the first rough draft screenplay of what was then called The Star Wars. It contains all the now familiar elements of Star Wars, an evil empire, a young would-be Jedi. There's a whole bunch of stuff. And I'd heard about certain changes that had been made in the run-up to the making Star Wars. There were certain things that I kind of vaguely knew about, that it was relatively familiar, but some of the names of characters were swapped around and stuff like that. I think they've gone back to an even earlier draft, though, that I didn't know about, because
this one with Princess Leia is an alien.
No. She's in it. It's you could try and map the changes all you wanted, and most of the changes are just characters and names to completely different things and completely different situations. The thing about this is it is completely unfamiliar from Star Wars beyond some of the names and some of the designs and stuff like that. It's almost completely different. This almost feels more like Flash Gordon or something. Like, well, no, Flash Gordon's a bad example. This is more of a space opera than Star Wars was. You know, I think we've talked about how tight, I don't know if it was on the podcast, but John and I were talking about how tight the original Star Wars film was, how it's literally, like I was saying about Sandman and Preacher and all of those books, it starts out, you're introduced to this young character, this young guy, and you get to see this ever-expanding conflict through his eyes. But the actual initial story is really, you learn about this world that George Lucas has created through the eyes of this character, and you don't see it beyond his experiences, really. You know, it cuts away to the droids sometimes. You see some of it through their eyes. But even that's a similar sort of very classic button-down structure that makes it easy for you to absorb. Whereas this is space opera and world building in that way that actually I think most people who read pulpy sci-fi really like, or if not the pulpy sci-fi, you know, the Dune books, but the classic fantasy series and classic science fiction series, it's much more like that. There's a huge cast of characters in this. There's lots of moving parts to the story, and in that there are Jedi, but it isn't even like with episodes 1 through 3 you saw that same universe explored through. This universe explored through a much more broad view. This universe is kind of built more to be explored this way, and it's some of it's quite naive. There is actually a character called Chaos, but spelt C-A-Y-O-S. He's like Count Chaos or something like that. King Chaos, but it's spelt K-A-Y-O-S. You can tell that George Lucas was... You can tell that George Lucas was pretty young when he wrote this. You know, that's a He-Man sort of level character naming going on there. But there's the Darklighters, and the worst thing about this comic, unless you really hate this like broad spanning sci fantasy stuff, the worst thing about this comic is the uncanny valley effect that you get from it not quite being Star Wars. You spend a lot of time reading it thinking, well, okay, I was expecting it to be so much closer to Star Wars than it was, that, like, you spend a lot of time waiting for the farm boy trope to turn up, you know, the small town guy in a big universe thing, and yeah. that never happens. But at the same time, characters will come along with names like there's a character in it called Anakin, who's the son of a guy called Luke Skywalker. It's spelled A-N-I-I-K-I-N. And you're like, well, no, that's not right. Anakin isn't Luke Skywalker's son. That's confusing. And Leia gets introduced, but she's someone else's daughter, and she is a princess, but she's a king's daughter. And Darth Vader's introduced, but he's just a really grody looking. He's just a really vicious looking sort of pseudo Nazi military. You know, you see his face.
Yeah,
there are robots. There are lightsabers and stuff like that. But the things that you identify as being pure Star Wars, the things that made those first few films hit so hard when they came out, the really simple archetypal characters aren't in this. It's a broad-spanning story that I liked because it's really nicely written, and Mike Mayhew's art on it is beautiful, and it's a really nice comic.
Do you almost think that if... say, just for the sake of argument, that had been released instead of the Star Wars that we know, do you think it would have been as big a hit?
I don't think so. I think as is quite typical, actually, of any sort of rewriting process, what George Lucas came back to was a much simpler story, and that's what grabbed people. You get this.
Only he could have remembered that.
Yeah, you get this galaxy-spanning story, but it's basically the story of two or three characters, like, navigating through it, and it all ends up being about that. So although it's called Star Wars, you get a whole chunk of the first act of the third film is about them going and rescuing one guy, and it's all about loyalty to that one guy and love to that one guy, rather than it being particularly strategically. Whereas this is much more like. About that. There's stuff about trade agreements in this.
Ah, that's where that came from.
But only a tiny little bit. And it's all got this very much more old-fashioned sort of feel to it, which is quite nice. Because the Jedi Knights in Star Wars always seem to be hearkening back to a time that wasn't borne out by the technology and the fact that they were farming using vaporators and everything was robots and stuff like that. Because they were called knights, which didn't really seem to fit.
The thing that always confused me with Star Wars is you look at all these stories like Knights of the Old Republic or whatever, which are from like 4,000 years ago, and absolutely none of the technology has changed at all.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not been any sort of evolutionary standpoint. The entire universe seems almost to have stagnated, but I don't know.
I think it was meant, there was a level at which it was meant to have, I think.
What, progressed?
No, I think there was a level at which it was supposed to be a universe that was in a much better state, and so a lot of the technology is supposed to be older and...
I think I remember someone saying to me it is actually explained in one of the 8 billion expanded universe books that they do explain why nothing has really changed.
We could end up talking about Star Wars a lot as well.
Yeah,
there are a few things in this that only really work really, really well because you're familiar with Star Wars. But actually, being familiar with Star Wars maybe made this as I've kind of said, it made it a lot harder for me to read because of that weird, uncanny valley effect.
You expected certain things to step in when actually, because I mean, I've heard about some of the original drafts he wrote, and they were nothing like Star Wars that we know.
You know, when you're watching a film about time travel, or you get an episode of something that's supposed to be a flashback episode of characters when they're younger, and the thing that I used to really like when I was a lot less cynical about stuff, but that now really annoys me, is when someone says something like, you can live with it in Back to the Future because it's quite cute, but when there are all of these references to really coy references to things that are going to happen in the future that are just for the audience and stuff like that,
the knowing winks,
a lot of this feels like that, but you're not sure how much of it is just because you're familiar with the story that this became,
or
how
or
much of it is the artist and writer doing it now. There's one bit in it with Star Destroyers which is just so cute, and if you're going to read it, I won't tell you about it, not just you, John, but the listener, obviously, because it's really cute. But it's about the Star Destroyers, and it couldn't work unless you're familiar with the films. It's very cool. I'm going to keep reading it because I really like the art and I really like the storytelling in it. And it's, and that's considering it's not a, I'm not a huge fan of space opera, really.
But and I'm, also I've it's quite probably going to be a limited series.
I think it's, I mean, it's, yeah, I think it's going to have to
be. I don't see it being an ongoing.
No. No, it probably isn't going to be an ongoing. But that's, I enjoyed it. I liked it. $3.99, so it is more expensive than I'd like. But it is a really nice looking book as well. And there's a little bit of back matter about how excellent, like, about how things changed quite a lot. I keep waiting for the Death Star to turn up and stuff. And that's hampering my enjoyment, but, you know.
A modern day comic fan, mean stride. Today's Stephen Lacey, mean pride. Stephen Lacey.
Good evening, monkeys. Well, goodness me, it's been a while. So I thought I'd better just get in and congratulate Nick on the Oh, that was a while ago? Okay. Well, at least you've done 200... Wait, what? Oh. Congratulations on yet another Momcast? Anyway, I was going to come here tonight and talk about my favourite DC title, but it appears that the counter on HasDCDoneSomethingStupidToday.com has reset with the departure of J.H. Williams and W. Aidan Blackman from Batwoman. I don't have a huge amount to say about this. Whilst I find the reasoning behind it to be really disappointing, the editorial interference doesn't particularly surprise me at this point. The stance on the marriage of Maggie Sawyer and Batwoman is a little more concerning, and DC really need to come out with a statement on this. But I gave up on Batwoman a while back. Really quite a while back. About 4 issues in, to the point where J.H. Williams was very clearly not doing the art anymore, somewhere towards the end of the first year. I just found the stories dull. The announcement doesn't affect me hugely because it's not a book I was buying. If anything, it gives me hope that Sandman Overture will be on time and won't suffer massive delays. But I'm going to introduce a bit of positivity and talk about my favourite New 52 book, and I know that it's one of Jane's favourites as well, and that is Wonder Woman by Brian Azzarello, with art most of the time by Cliff Chang. I absolutely love Wonder Woman. I was never a huge reader beforehand. I'm aware that there are some very notable runs by creators like George Perez, John Byrne, Phil Jimenez, Gail Simone. I read some of the Greg Rucka stuff leading into Infinite Crisis, but it was good comics, but it never really struck me as being particularly great comics. I probably wouldn't have picked her up in the New 52 if it hadn't been for the creative team. I absolutely love Cliff Chang's art, and Brian Azzarello is someone, whilst I may not always enjoy his comics, he's a bit like Grant Morrison, I will always give them a shot because there's always something interesting going on. The two actually had worked together previously on the backup strips for the Tales of the Unexpected series, which was kind of the one and only big thing that the Christopher Alan Spector had between Infinite Crisis and the end of DC as we knew it. They did this fantastic Doctor 13 backup strip that ended up just kind of knocking holes in metafiction and things like that. Just a very fun strip and well worth checking out if you find the issues cheaply. I think there'd be something really rather special with Wonder Woman. It's one of the few auteur visions in the DC universe, to the point where Azzarello looks very uncomfortable when he's on DC panels and people are asking, oh, how does your Wonder Woman match up with the one from the Justice League? You can read this in complete isolation. It could be the only DC title you buy, and you would be getting an amazing story. There was some really good stuff going on in the first year involving the Sons and Daughters of Zeus, a different Wonder Woman origin. Let's face it, if you're rebooting the universe from the start, you might as well move away from, oh, she's made of clay, and bring in some of the nastier, darker elements of Greek mythology. And this one did quite happily. But it was the end of the first year, the end of issue 12, just before that 0 month, I think they called it, where one of the characters was musing on the time of the gods maybe coming to an end, and you know, the time of the old gods is over, I think is what they said. And the final panel was just the classic text saying boom over a boom tube, and if you know your fourth world, you know that the boom of a boom tube is done in a very specific way. And I felt really excited reading that, because I couldn't think of a better way of reintroducing the non-apocalypse versions of the new gods, by which I mean like the new Genesis ones, things like Highfather Orion, the Forever People. And that's what they did in the second year after that fantastic Zero issue, which was a wonderful pastiche of an era of comics that never really seemed to exist, but also tied in to the ongoing story. Orion became a member of the cast. We went to New Genesis. We met Highfather. And it's just been a real blast of a ride. Azrael has also done a great trick of killing off two characters that he's introduced over the past couple of years and made each of those deaths matter. One of them leaping down a boom tube to take on the Firstborn while singing Millwall supporters' football club chant. You've got to love that kind of irreverence. The other death happening at the end of issue 24, which I'm not going to spoil for those who haven't read it, but it really changes a lot of stuff within the series and makes you really question what you've been reading so far. The artwork, Cliff Chang, is fantastic. What's been really great about this book is there have been fill-in artists on it, but each of the fill-in artists, and I think the two main ones are Tony Akins and Goran Suzuka, both of those have fitted really well in. Think when Joe Quinones takes over from Mike Allred on FF, or Kate Brown replacing Jeremy McKelvey for an issue of Young Avengers, where the art is so well matched that you almost don't notice that the regular artist is gone. And that displays a little bit of artistic integrity that DC has been lacking, let's be honest on this. I think Wonder Woman's fantastic. I think there's going to be a great jumping on point after the Villains Month, and Azzarello is writing one of the Villains Month issues, which I really can't wait to get my hands on. I also think it's going to be one of the strongest trade reads going, because there is a clear, consistent vision. It's going to be one that, if I had to nominate any run from the New 52 to be collected in absolute format, it would be this one, and I think you could easily get an entire volume out of the 2 years published so far. I think it's that good. Anyway, yes, go buy Wonder Woman, track down the trades, read them. It's a cracking read. Anyway, monkeys, great to chat with you all again, and substitute monkey away!
I just want to very, very quickly, I want to mention something that's happened in the new, in the comic news in the today, really. This is another one of those conversations that could end up running really long, and I don't want it to, because I'm already kind of tired of the story a little bit. I'm preempting where I know it's going to go based on the IO9 website response I saw to it. The headline, which I hadn't noticed before, is DC forbids Batwoman's gay marriage, creative team leaves. And the story is that J.H. Williams III and W. Hayden Blackman have announced they'll be leaving Batwoman, citing DC's editorial interference in the book. Now, the headline gets its quite inflammatory. It's quite a suggestive headline, and it's quite inflammatory. Basically, the straw that has broken the camel's back is that they were not allowed, the creative team were not allowed to have Kate Kane and her partner Maggie Sawyer marry each other in the comic. So people are obviously very, very quickly deciding that this is about stifling gay marriage, or stifling representation of gay marriage in comics. There might be something in that, except that this comic has never had any trouble with its main character being gay, as far as I can tell. But what it has had is a history of editorial interference throughout, like almost every other book at DC. Every other story that comes out of DC at the moment is about editorial interference. And editorial interference that doesn't seem malicious, but just doesn't seem to make much sense. And that's why I kind of don't want to get too snarled up on it. It's just really worth mentioning, because it's going to have been a political decision that's going to be made more it's going to be more politicized by the agendas of the people reporting it. And this IO9 article ties itself in so many loops, reporting the facts and reporting what Williams has said about how this isn't about this specific decision, but about the how frustrating it is to be trying to tell a story and get last-minute editorial things. And the fact that everything in the there have been loads of stories about editorial interference at DC. He tries to tie it into the Orson Scott Card thing as well, but in a really awkward way that just involves mentioning the Orson Scott Card thing in the same paragraph as mentioning the other gay marriage that happened in the DC universe recently, and this one.
Who was the other gay marriage?
Was it Alan Scott in?
I was going to say, was it Alan Scott?
Yeah, and I have a problem with that sort of reporting, because it's like, if I say these three things that are kind of along a similar theme in one paragraph together, then it will insinuate that there is a connection between them. But actually, there is no. The suggestion he makes is that that DC are stopping this gay marriage because they didn't want to draw attention to the controversy about Orson Scott Card on Superman. As if that makes any sense. Why would you stifle representation of gay people to draw attention away from your homophobic creator elsewhere? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go home and read that article, because it sounds like, I don't know. I mean,
it's odd. I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it feels to me like DC's, there's weird stuff going on at DC Editorial. But there's some phrase, and I can't remember the exact thing of it, about never assuming malice when it could just be incompetence.
Sounds more likely.
The actual quote is much better than that. But it can be seen as a slightly homophobic decision, but it's not necessarily been made by homophobic people.
It seems very odd that it would be a homophobic decision, considering that they've been very open about sort of the relationships between homosexual characters in the past, and they've represented them, well, in the case of Batwoman in particular, the original Greg Rucker and J.H. Williams run, it was very well represented, and it even dealt very well with the whole idea of gay people in the military. So for DC to suddenly come back and go, oh no, we don't like this, and to say that that's homophobic, I don't think it is, because it doesn't gel with what they've done in the past.
It's suggesting a very malicious order where there's actually most likely just chaos.
Whereas from what you've said as well about J.H. Williams isn't leaving because they've said, no, you can't have a gay marriage. From the sounds of it, he's leaving because he's just like, I'm trying to tell a story and you schmuckos just keep
They're just about to put a story out, as like 11th hour decisions happening all the time. We've been hearing about this since before DC 52 started, so it's kind of, it just seems like the thing over there. I'd be interesting to know what the listener thinks.
Yep, please let us know.
But John and I have been in this room for what seems like a really long time, so we aren't going to dwell on it right now. We're just going to bring it up, throw that hand grenade out there. And the hand grenade's already out there in the internet anyway. So, John, what are you doing the rest of your week? Writing reviews, masturbating, looking for jobs.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
Sounds good. It's how I'd like to be spending my week.
Yeah.
I think we have the first weekend in ages that isn't already booked solid, so that's quite nice.
But you've got a baby, so
it's all, there'll be people over,
that's
it.
That's kind of your weekends for the rest of your life booked solid.
Yeah, one way or another, it's going to be busy. But you know, it is the most important thing I've ever done. So, are you going to be around next week? It's going to be Jane will hopefully be back.
Yeah, I should be around next week.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Cool.
I think it remains to thank the contributors who've done a really good job. Thank you.
Thank yous.
And the listener, you're always patient. I'm sorry that I've been a bit off on one. And John's been very patient. Thank you, John, for being very patient.
It's all right. Thank you, Nick.
I think that's all the weather. Bye-bye.
I think I've read like 40 odd Stephen King books, and don't worry, I won't list them. I think his... Oh, you can hear that.
Yeah, it's
the thing with Stephen King books is that he sometimes pays off, sometimes kind of meanders, falls over, doesn't know what he's doing, and that's it. Just awful.
So what you're saying is that Stephen King sometimes drifts around, meanders, and falls off. Do you not think that's in slightly poor taste? Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Try that again, John. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Fucking hell. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.